job requirements included having triggered a tantrum by a pompous, angry, multi-million dollar athlete, they'd be unbelievably overqualified for the job. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Well, once again, 2 o'clock rolls around. Early, I'm not prepared. Writer's Block, Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch. I don't even have my iPhone plugged in.
You want me to handle the first part of the show?
No, I think I can wing it. I think I can figure this out. So did you step and watch the whole game last night? Raptors and Clippers?
Yeah, I went to bed at 1. I've not gotten enough sleep this week.
Looks like it.
I'm going to be terrible on the show, I predict.
There you go. All right, well.
But I'm glad I did because, once again, Jeff, very, very exciting game to watch. Really, really particularly interesting. Obviously, they ran out of gas in the fourth quarter. Their legs were spent, but I was dead wrong. I said yesterday on the show, I thought the Clippers were going to blow them out back-to-back. Sort of figure like the emotion of Kawhi might get the better of Toronto as opposed to Los Angeles. I could not have been more wrong. They went down a little bit, stayed in that game, sort of fought back. Once again, contributions from guys, whether it was Boucher or Terrence Davis, Pascal and Fred just logging yeoman's minutes, and they hung around. I mean, that game, if you watch till the end, you know, Pascal missed a three. That would have cut it to 3. I think somebody got a rebound and made it 4. But you know what I'm saying? Like, Jeff, there were times in the last 3 minutes where one possession, that game's tied.
There were a whole bunch of guys who outplayed Kawhi Leonard yesterday.
Kawhi Leonard did not. He had a bad game.
I was going to say there were about 5 of them. Yeah. 5 of them on the Raptors. And I loved what Nick Nurse did early in the game. I mean, I love the idea of channeling all the energy, all the emotion you know is going to be there, and channeling it into a defensive game plan that stresses swarming Kawhi Leonard. Kawhi Leonard was going to be the object of everybody's attention last night, mentally anyhow. All his teammates, former teammates' attention mentally anyhow. So why not? Why not just swarm him? And I thought it was, I will tell you, I don't think last year we spent enough time talking about Nick Nurse as a coach because Kawhi was there. And when we did talk to him, I think, or talk about him, it was more or less, boy, if Dwayne had Kawhi, he might have been able to pull this off too. But I've seen so much from Nick Nurse this season so far. Not that he has to, you know, certainly doesn't have to impress Jeff Blair. But I've seen so much from him in terms of how he has his team prepared to play, and most importantly, how hard they play for him.
Yeah.
That was the team playing for its coach last night.
Well, so a couple things. Hubie Brown said when we talked to him about Nick Nurse, like the thing that impressed him most was courage. Nick Nurse believes in his convictions. He believes what he believes, and he's not afraid to call a certain defense at a certain time. He's not afraid to run a play for a certain player. So that's one. Two, what's very clear, Jeff, just like the Clippers, is the buy-in from the Raptors players. Like, they believe in their coach. They will follow what their coach says. In the NBA, that does not always happen.
Oh, God, no.
Certain times, like, once a coach gets tuned out, I mean, we've seen this in a lot of LeBron James teams, it's over for that coach. Like, these Raptors believe and buy and listen to what Nick has to say. Third, one of the things, Jeff, that actually I really was impressed by Nick, and again, maybe he could do this a little bit because he won a championship and he's got a little bit of, he's got a little bit of gold, let's say, in the safe. But he was unafraid to call out guys in the preseason, Rondé, Hollis Jefferson, Stanley Johnson. And he sort of challenged his guys early. That's not always something you see with an NBA coach. And in Rondé Hollis Jefferson's case, last 2 games, that guy's been unbelievable. I mean, he's been a legitimate rotation player who provides value for this team. But I think you might be onto something. You know, understandably, the players in the NBA, I mean, players in every sport, are going to get credit when you win a championship. But, you know, maybe we should reevaluate a little bit the assessment of Nick Nurse. And he's not just sort of a push-button coach, but really has some interesting philosophies that may get you a couple of additional wins. But they've, I've said this before, and this is to me the most impressive thing about the Raptors in the last 18 months. I sort of sent this out on Twitter yesterday. Their defining culture, Jeff, right now, or the most prominent part of their basketball culture is resiliency. They do not quit in games, ever. And even when they're down, and I think Kawhi said that after the game last night, even when they're down, there's a self-belief in guys like Van Vliet and Pascal and others on the court that they can come back. And time and time again, even if they end up losing the game, they come back within games. You can't be, I'm really absolutely just so impressed with this group right now.
Yeah, look, it's one thing to get the attention of Rondae Hollis-Jefferson and Chris Boucher and guys who are, and Terrence Davis, guys who are trying to make their bones in the NBA, right? You should have their attention anyhow because they're playing for minutes, they're playing for contracts, they're playing for a place in an organization that, let's face it, in 2 years is going to look a hell of a lot different than it does right now in terms of its lineup because of finances and things of that nature. So that doesn't surprise me. I'd be upset if Chris Boucher and Terrence Davis and Rondae Hollis-Jefferson and Matt Thomas weren't giving what they're giving right now. What has impressed me, and we've seen this in the NBA, I mean, there are nights, and can I put this politely, there are nights where NBA players kind of take a night off. They just do. It's a long season. We've talked, it's a social league. There are nights where guys just kind of, they don't have it. They just don't have it. And it would be very easy for Pascal Siakam and Fred VanVleet and Marc Gasol to just kind of, got my ring. It's Monday night in November. Back to back. You know, we'll just kind of.
How about this? Los Angeles, beautiful people. Yeah. I went out Sunday night.
Yeah, break a sweat maybe and we'll keep it close. But they played hard. And as I said, at the end of the night, Nick Nurse is absolutely right. His team was better on the night than the Clippers. And Kawhi Leonard was not one of the top five players on the floor. He just wasn't.
Still effective in the fourth quarter.
Oh, he was effective. Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that.
Yeah, but I know what you're saying.
But I'm saying he, for most of the game, if you didn't, in any other game, right, if Kawhi Leonard hadn't won a title with the Raptors and it was just another Raptors game, no one would have been talking about Kawhi Leonard. No. Because he didn't do jack for three quarters other than poke OG Anunoby's eye out, essentially.
The Clippers won that game because of Lou Williams and Montrezl Harrell. That's why they ended up.
And they're going to win a lot of games because those two are.
Well, the one thing, I will say this. If you're an NBA fan and you stayed up last night, and if you did, God bless you. I'm impressed by that. The one thing you could see with the Clippers, Jeff, is when Paul George comes back and all the attention's on Kawhi, that's like what's going to. This is why the NBA is always like a two- or three-star league. So just think about last night. The Raptors were incredibly effective on Kawhi. They doubled him all over the court. Now, if Kawhi kicks out on the double and it's Paul George as opposed to player X, that's why the Clippers could be great because Paul George is a 30-point kind of scorer. And so you can sort of see the potential of the Clippers when Paul George comes back healthy. But, again, like those guys are just professionals. And, you know, I don't know if like Masai and the scouts sort of like, do you think you can, I mean, maybe you can, like, can you scout makeup, Jeff? Like, do you think like,
I mean, the only way you can scout makeup is to,
like, do you think you sort of Fred VanVleet or when you're picking up like a free agent, like Terrence Davis, like the Raptor scouts must have some pretty good ability, I think, to figure out makeup or figure out. Or draft players who,
the only way you figure out a player's makeup, I mean, if he's in college for 4 years, like, you know what Norm Powell's about. You talked to his coach.
Well, you've probably, you know,
seen him, seen him play. Yeah. Same thing with Fred VanVleet. You don't scout makeup. You talk to people.
But it gets discounted, don't you think, for skill? Well, Jeff, I mean, VanVleet didn't go in the first round.
No, but I'm saying, yeah, but that's.
Or potential, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no one's going to take a guy in the first round because he's a good dude. If he can't play, it doesn't matter if you're a good dude.
Well, less about good dude and more about how does a guy in moments where you are under significant distress as a team.
I don't think you can't possibly know that until you see the guy do it. Playing for Wichita State and being under moments of stress for Wichita State is nothing like playing under stress when you're playing in the NBA.
Oh, I agree with that.
I mean, I think makeup is value added for high draft picks. I think makeup can be when you're deciding who you're going to sign as a free agent, when you're, you know, sort of sifting through the guys who didn't get drafted, right. The first thing you're going to do is say, okay, is there something we don't know about this guy? Why were other teams not on him as well? Once you do that due diligence, then you look at him, and if he's got a skill set that appeals to you, yeah, but I don't believe for a second there is a team out there that scouts personality first. Or
not
makeup first.
I agree with
over
you.
Skill.
Not first, but I do think certain organizations seem to have a really good skill about finding players, let's say, who are free agent types or late round picks who seem to have really strong makeup for the NBA. Like Pascal is a perfect example. Late first round pick, but always has a motor and doesn't ever seem to get, the moment doesn't seem too big for him, which for some high draft picks, particularly in the NBA, a lot of times it does. But I know where you're coming from.
Yeah.
Again, I think we talked about this yesterday. It might have been Donovan who said it or Arden who said it. But there's not enough conversation about the developmental arm of the Raptors.
No, there isn't.
How good that is.
98-88 was the score last night, by the way. And
but it was a 4-point game, really.
Yes, essentially it was a 4-point game. And Don, you know, your point about Donovan is right. We don't talk enough about Raptors 905. We don't talk enough about the development that goes on at the NBA level, right? But it's something that, you see, I would argue that is part of the Raptors' DNA more than the ability to identify people. The Raptors have an ability, and they've had an ability I don't know how long I could go back, but every year they have developed somebody internally for the most part who ends up making a contribution. Last year they didn't really have to because they had Kawhi and they had Danny Green, but it's almost every year, whether it's Pascal or whether it was Norm Powell, or certainly Fred VanVleet, you can go back and back and back, and you can even include DeMar DeRozan in that. They have always had an ability, I would argue, probably post Vince, they have always had an ability to develop a guy every year, to have a guy take a step forward every year. And this year, in addition to the, you know, the Chris Boucher's and that, Pascal Siakam may turn out to be the biggest, the biggest example of that. These are some numbers. This is from NBA.com. Pascal Siakam, with Siakam on the floor, Toronto's net rating is plus 9.5. Mm. When he's off the floor, it's minus 9.7.
Wow.
If you look at Pascal Siakam, he's shooting 95% from the free throw line. This is a guy who shot 78.5% last year, 62.1% the season before. He's basically improved by a third. He's basically improved by a third over the course of 2 years. You know, he's not afraid now to take 3-point shots. And you know, some of these numbers, and NBA.com did a great job of breaking this down. Some of these numbers, and Pascal's part of this as well, you know, scoring inside, they're the hardest team in the NBA to score inside on right now.
Which is really interesting because they're not the biggest team in the NBA.
They're not the biggest team in the NBA, but that gets to the point, I think, that there is, you know, we could talk about resilience with this team and that, but to me, the standout aspect of the Toronto Raptors under Masai Ujiri has been how efficient they are in terms of developing players and getting the best out of players who may not have gotten a sniff elsewhere.
Yeah, well,
and you know, Fred VanVleet is the
poster child of the
same with Norm Powell. Yeah. You know, Norm Powell drives us nuts, but to get what you got out of Norm Powell so far in the NBA, based on how you got him, is pretty impressive.
Oh, yeah, it's gravy. The thing about Pascal that I wasn't sure about this year is how would he be, Jeff, as a number one option. Like how, you know, without Kawhi Leonard there, most of the plays are going to be run through him at a certain point. And certainly in crunch time, they're going to be going through him or Kyle, obviously. And he's been unbelievable. He's accepted that challenge. You look at his statistics this year, they're off the mat. and they're off the chart. And you know, I think heading into the season, Jeff, people probably put, all right, Pascal Siakam's, you know, he's a top 30 player. Does he ceiling out at top 30 or can he go up? To me now, he's one of the 15 best players in the league.
Oh, I think he's, and this is
and,
not.
And fast rising, which makes you, you know, that's the kind of player you have to win a
title. I'm not the only person to say this, but Pascal's going to be a legit MVP candidate this
year.
Unless his team falls off the face of the earth, which I don't see happening. I don't think any team in the East is going to fall off the face of the earth for the most part, other than the Knicks. But I don't think any of the contending teams in the East are going to fall off the face of the earth. He's going to be a legit MVP candidate.
Yeah, he is now. I mean, you know, we got to hopefully.
Those numbers, though, I didn't realize that. But when you can look at a guy, sometimes in an analytical age, you got to do a real deep dive into a guy to find numbers that show how he's improved.
Yeah.
You just look at Pascal's raw numbers. I mean, they're like slapping you in the face. How much the guy has improved as a player.
It is crazy to look at his numbers in 2016 and then look at it today.
Oh,
it's like
a different player.
Yeah.
It's like you're looking at a different player.
Again.
And maybe you are.
His numbers today, like, that's a top three pick in the NBA draft, or top two. Like,
easy.
He's easy. You know, so it's video game like jump. And, you know, we're only, whatever, 12 games into the season or something like that. But, you know, these numbers, Jeff, are pretty close, like by game 40, then you have to start talking MVP.
Yep.
Because his numbers are going to be with Harden and Giannis and the rest of the guys in the league who put up just crazy numbers every year.
And when you do that on a team that's lost a guy.
Exactly.
That is probably the consensus choice is one of the, you know, I mean, you can make the case Kawhi is the best player in the NBA.
I think
but that's yeah. Knowing how people vote in MVP voting. If you are the best player on a team that gets to the playoffs,
right,
despite losing Kawhi Leonard, despite losing Danny Green, I mean, that's the type of stuff people take into account when they sit there and look at MVP votes. So just a rundown as to where we're going today. Eric Smith, our Raptors radio voice on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, will join us. In a few minutes, the Raptors' next game is against the Portland Trail Blazers. Our next Raptors broadcast is against the Charlotte Hornets Monday back home at Scotiabank Arena on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet Ontario. Jovan Buha is the Clippers' beat writer with The Athletic. He will join us at 3 o'clock. We'll take a look at last night's game and Kawhi Leonard from the L.A. point of view. Elliot Friedman joins us, Amy Trask as well, and we'll deal with this breaking story at broke about half an hour before we went on air. Ken Rosenthal of The Athletic and Evan Drellich of The Athletic reporting that the Houston Astros apparently were stealing signs electronically in 2017. And amongst the sources they cite for this is Mike Fiers, who is a pitcher with the Astros. And that in itself is interesting because my first reaction was, upon hearing the story, all right, there's no way this stays secret because there's so much player movement in Major League Baseball. If this is happening, some former player is going to talk about it. Boom. There you go. Mike Fiers is that former player. So, lots ahead. It's Writer's Block with Blair and Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Now, Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590.
Okay, it's about to go down. Please step up. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Here we go. It's the return. Burn like a supernova. Spin the plate. The great debate's over. Don't rush.
All right, welcome back to Writer's Block on 590 and 360. A reminder that the Leafs' next game is Wednesday night. Tomorrow night, you can hear it on Sportsnet 590. The Fan, watch it in Sportsnet Ontario. Scotiabank Wednesday night hockey's pregame at 6:30 p.m. Puck drops just after 7. As always, Leafs Nation postgame with Elberga and Stellick right after the final horn on Sportsnet 590. The Fan. The Toronto Raptors fell 98-88 to Kawhi Leonard and the L.A. Clippers yesterday, the second back-to-back games in Los Angeles. Richard and myself spent a great deal, well, spent most of our time, spent all of our time, frankly, in the first part of the show talking about it. Again, a game where the Toronto Raptors did not have Kyle Lowry, did not have Pascal Siakam, did not have Patrick McCaw, and
NOG
for most of the game after he lost his eye, essentially. Well, I mean, I'm overstating things. He is seeing an eye specialist today, by the way. But it was sort of a repeat of what we saw against the Los Angeles Lakers, except the Raptors didn't finish it off. But Richard's right. It was essentially, the score, frankly, flatters the Clippers as much as a 10-point win can flatter anybody. This was Fred VanVleet after the game talking about whether or not this constituted a moral victory, the fact that the Raptors were able to hold Kawhi Leonard and the Clippers as close as they did.
I mean, he got the win, so I don't know if we're into moral victories, but we definitely went in trying to take him out of the game, and he got a lot of our focus and just making it tough on him and making him work and throwing four or five bodies at him and letting somebody else shoot. So those guys, they burned us on the glass, but I thought our coverages were good. We guarded them pretty well. Like I said, just 88 is not going to get it done against that team there. So it's a hell of a team to play off of back-to-back, shorthanded. And, you know, we fought hard, but this wasn't enough tonight.
Let's bring in Eric Smith. He is our Raptors radio voice on Sportsnet 590 Fan. Hello, E.
Jeff, how you doing?
I'm doing well. You know what? The thing that really amazed, well, I should say a thing that amazed me last night, the thing that I found fascinating listening to the post-game commentary was Kawhi Leonard saying afterwards that they, being the Raptors, ran a whole bunch of defense at him that he didn't see last year, which just gets to the point. Nick Nurse has got a championship ring, and I know we focus on the postseason, obviously. It's hard not to. But, man, he's had a couple of really, really, Nick Nurse I'm talking about, really good games these past 2 days, hasn't he?
Yeah, he really has, and I mean, I think it was a false narrative before. It was an inaccurate narrative, but I think at least 10 games into the season, and certainly the last two games, there are more people, whether they be hardcore fans or casual fans, and I'm talking more so stateside and not necessarily the Raptor rabid fan base, that are maybe starting to realize that the story, or as I said, the narrative that was out there last year, that it was Kawhi Leonard carrying the Raptors to the final, or Kawhi Leonard being, you know, kind of a lone dog in Toronto, couldn't be anywhere further from the truth. You know, people maybe are guilty of forgetting about Kyle Lowry, you know, and his multi-time All-Stars and the emergence of Siakam and VanVleet last year, and let alone, you know, the buttons that were pressed by Nick Nurse and the fact that Ibaka came on and Powell provided some consistency and some steadiness and the acquisition of Gasol and everything kind of coming together. And on top of that, the Raptors playing a quarter of the season without Kawhi Leonard and going 17-5 in those games as well. So as good as he was, and as much as he would have loved to have seen him come back, and as great as he was in the postseason, there were still plenty of other sort of hero type moments, go-to moments for a lot of other guys, not just in the regular season, but in the playoffs, where you wouldn't have maybe beat Golden State if not for the play of Kyle Lowry in that game six, or the shot making and the defense and just the tenacity of a Fred VanVleet, or the savvy of a Marc Gasol. The list goes on. So I think, you know, very early on this season, all of these folks that were maybe writing off the Raptors or downplaying their chances this year, or how good they could actually be simply because Kawhi was gone, they're maybe starting to, you know, wake up and realize this team is still pretty good. And the chemistry, the familiarity, let alone the coach and the consistency with the coaching staff, might ultimately make a big difference for Toronto this year.
Eric, let's go over a couple of the people who are injured at the moment and whatever kind of update you can provide. What is the latest you've heard on Kyle Lowry in terms of a timeout?
Minimum 2 weeks. Reevaluated after that, Richard, and I would imagine, and again, I'm just purely speculating, it doesn't seem like it's anything too severe. Even the bandage that he's wearing on his thumb, it's not like it's a soft cast or even a big hard cast or anything. It's a wrap around the thumb, so it doesn't seem overly severe. It's on the non-shooting hand, but at the same time, based on how things go, and you know this these days in pro sports, it's not just, with due respect, the medical staff, the training staff of the Raptors. A lot of times it's being sent off to see a specialist, so by the time you rest and rehab for a couple of weeks, go see a specialist, it could maybe extend beyond that. And again, that's just me speculating, but I would say we're looking at least a couple of weeks for Lowry. So that brings us probably close to the end of the month at the earliest. I haven't heard anything new in terms of the time frame for Serge Ibaka, but I do know that he left the team in Los Angeles and has gone back to Toronto to rehab. And I think a large portion of that is to simply, you know, cut down on the travel and the wear and tear in his body, because the Raptors still aren't home for almost a week. They don't come home till Sunday after leaving today for L.A., heading to Portland, not playing Portland till tomorrow, then not playing Dallas until Saturday. It's still a pretty long haul ahead, and that saves Ibaka at least a few flights. Just get him straight home to Toronto and rehab with some of the training staff back there. I believe at least one of the trainers that was on the road flew back with Ibaka to kind of deal with him at the Raptors practice facility. And then, of course, the latest now is OG Anunoby. And I wish I had something more for you other than what they said last night after the game. We're getting set to hop on the plane in about 90 minutes or so to leave L.A. And what we were told last night, and I haven't heard an update this morning, was that Anunoby was going to visit an eye specialist this morning in L.A. And then would be updated from there. So it didn't look good last night. I couldn't see the eyeball itself because he was wearing an eye patch. And there was some swelling on the side of the eye itself. But again, I didn't see the actual eyeball. So I have to just go based on what, you know, the players were saying and what Nurse was saying in terms of being scratched pretty badly and bleeding pretty well as well. So that certainly doesn't sound like a great combination.
Yeah, no. you knock on wood there, and you hope that there's some healing really quick. But that's a scary one, and we'll obviously keep people updated on that. Eric, I want to ask you about...
Sorry to cut you off there. I left out Patrick McCaw, with no disrespect to McCaw, who's still trying to come get back in the lineup. And again, respectfully, he didn't make a major impact in the short time that we saw him this season, but Nurse was at least projecting him and planning on him to be in his top eight. I mean, throughout training camp and the preseason and even the early stages of the regular season, we weren't hearing a whole lot about Rondae Hollis-Jefferson or Stanley Johnson or even Terrence Davis and Matt Thomas, for that matter. It was going to be Ibaka, Powell, and McCaw as the primary guys off the bench, with McCaw eating up a lot of those backup point guard minutes with the Raptors starting both Van Vliet and Lowry. So if you want to even throw McCaw into the mix, you know, we talk about Lowry, Ibaka, and Anunoby as three of the top six. Well, we're now talking about McCaw throw in there. That's four of your top eight guys out of the lineup, which, you know, clearly puts Toronto behind big time and, you know, sets them up for a tough one in Portland and Dallas. And sorry to cut you off. I'll go back to you now.
Yeah, no problem at all. So this brings up the sort of the question of, in your opinion, where do you think Nick Nurse's confidence, particularly over the last, obviously, two games, where is his confidence now in playing Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, Chris Boucher, Matt Thomas? I'm trying to think.
And Terrence Davis.
Yeah, and Terrence Davis. So where I would think now, after these two games, Nick has to feel better, right, about significant, maybe significance too strong, about more minutes with that group, that quartet.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the easier answer, I suppose, as well is, well, he's got no choice. He doesn't have enough bodies. But at the same time, because of the fact that they've performed as well as they have, I mean, the numbers are out there all over Instagram and Twitter and otherwise. I'm not, you know, splitting the atom and breaking any news here. But you look at what the Raptors have done the last two games against LeBron James and Kawhi Leonard. They've held those two players, arguably the top two players in the game, to 26 points total. And I think it was on 7 of 26 shooting. And a large chunk of that was Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, who couldn't even get on the floor the first, you know, 6, 7, 8 ball games of the season. And has certainly, you know, waited his time and waited it out. And as a side note to that, for a lot of the fans that might hit you guys up or certainly hit me up on Twitter and otherwise saying, why isn't this guy playing? And what's Nurse doing? He's riding this guy too hard. People have got to realize this isn't just, you know, Nurse just saying, oh, I'm not going to play him. He's obviously seeing, or more specifically, not seeing things in practice that he wants to see, and holding guys accountable and wanting them to be better. And now, you know, whether it be through opportunity or simply just circumstance, because of the injuries, he's had to play these guys. And to their credit, they've stepped up. Boucher and Hollis-Jefferson specifically have certainly played extremely well in the last couple of games, even the last few, if we go back to the New Orleans game for Boucher as well. And I think they're mainstays now in that second unit. Even as the Raptors get healthy, it seems like those are guys you need to find minutes for. The defense that Hollis-Jefferson played last night specifically on Kawhi Leonard, I thought was outstanding. But then when you look at, you know, Terrence Davis, the energy that he brings, the thing that to me stands out more than anything with Terrence at this point, for a rookie, an undrafted guy, he doesn't play with any kind of fear. You know, he's got that edge, that chip on his shoulder. He's you know, making big shots in the corner in front of the Lakers bench a couple of nights ago, late in the ball game. He wants the ball. He wants the moment, and that's huge. And then have a sharp shooter like Matt Thomas who can come in, come off screens, knock down threes with consistency. And he's starting to show me that he's not just a one-dimensional player in terms of being only a shooter. He might not be, or at least he hasn't shown yet, to be a fantastic playmaker. But the fact that he's able to keep his man in front of him and play defense, he's not a lockdown guy. He's not going to be ever, you know, tapped on the shoulder to go in and be a shutdown guy. But if he can keep his man in front of him, if he can keep his feet moving and at least play respectable defense, that's going to keep him on the floor for longer stretches because of his offense and because of the fact that I think he's starting to make a name for himself already up, you know, with opposing teams around the league as being a guy that you have to be concerned about from the perimeter.
You're going to have to explain something to me, Eric. This is from our friends at NBA.com who put a pretty interesting look together at this team, things we've learned about the Raptors so far. This is not the biggest team in the NBA. They don't have Serge Ibaka. Yet opponents, or they haven't had him for the past couple of games. Yet opponents are shooting 51% against them in the restricted area. That's the stingiest mark in the league by miles. Explain that to me.
I think they're packing the paint in a little bit more, Jeff, in terms of everybody kind of pinching in. I think that they're willing to, listen, they don't want to give up wide open looks on the mm-hmm. perimeter. They want to close out the shooters. But I think they're willing to let you beat them or you know, we're willing to give something up. We've got to give up something. I think at this level, if you're an NBA coach, if you're an NBA player, the talent of these guys is so good that you're not going to stop everything and everyone on every single night. So you're going to have to sort of pick your poison, to pardon the cliche. And I think the Raptors are saying, because of our size issues, we have to help. We have to send 2-3 bodies. We have to try and cut off the rim. Thus, what's left? Well, we might be exposed then on the perimeter, but it's not simply just fine, give up the open shot, because I can remember and think back to 4-6 weeks ago in training camp and watching one of the drills the Raptors were working on, and it was to kind of pinch, help, and then close out and get out there. And then also, when you close out, be able to recover, because if you go flying past your man, if he kind of stops on a dime, steps in, up fake, tries to sidestep, and as you close out, and you know, it's not just a wild closeout with a sweeping block attempt, it's close out, you know, with conviction, close out with control of your body. But if you do get by, make sure you can still recover. And I think that's got to be a major reason for it at this point, Jeff. And it's their defense overall. I mean, Jonesy tracks the number. I'll give him the credit for this. And I don't even know the exact number. Well, I'll hit Paul up on Twitter. I'm sure he'll have it for you in an instant. But the last 4 or 5 years, the Raptors have made a name for themselves, not just with the paint defense that you're talking about, but their defense overall. When they hold teams under 45%, that's kind of been the watermark. The Raptors have something like a 60-7 record when they hold teams under 45%. Twice already this year, they've held teams under 40% and lost. Mm. Last night and the Celtics game. So I think as much as that we give them credit for their paint defense and how well they're playing defensively, they become this lockdown defensive team. I think part of the problem, though, is because of the lack of size, they're giving up a ton of extra chances on offensive rebounds, and right. they're beginning to destroy it in the offensive glass, rebounding overall at second chance points, and that's giving a ton of extra possessions or extra looks to the opposing team.
So they're now going to face the Portland Trail Blazers, and that is going to be it's great to pack the paint and all that good stuff, but Portland might be able to have a little bit of success if that's the Raptors' approach, right?
Probably, yeah, because they've got a couple of pretty damn good shooters and, mm-hmm. and players on the perimeter in their backcourt with, you know, maybe the most dynamic, especially if we factor in the injuries now in Golden State, might be the most currently healthy backcourt in the league. And when you think of C.J. McCollum and, of course, Damian Lillard. So that's it's going to be no easy task by any means. Portland's kind of sputtered a little bit. They've been inconsistent, to say the least, out of the gates here. And, you know, maybe it's one of those things where, you know, get them early in the season in the first 10, 15 games, as opposed to getting them in March when they've got things clicking. So maybe this is when you kind of want them. And the Raptors should be at the very least, albeit undermanned, coming in a little bit healthier rested, not practicing today. And then just, you know, coming into the ballgame with, you know, fairly fresh legs tomorrow. But they're going to need it because it's certainly tough with that backcourt. And I'll tell you, it's even tougher going into that building specifically. You know, we often talk about Toronto and Golden State and Utah. I would put Portland in the top five in terms of buildings to go to, the noise, the fans, and the home court advantage that exists in that joint up in Portland.
Eric, once upon a time, Marc Gasol would have been one of the primary scorers for his team. When he was in Memphis, we're talking about a 17, 18, 19 point a game guy. Where do you think he is right now, particularly with the group that's injured? Where do you think he is in terms of being a legitimate offensive guy you can run plays for?
I hear where you're going with it, Richard, and I agree with you that you'd like to see a little bit more. I don't know if the way the Raptors are currently constructed and the way that their offense flows, if it's best to run stuff for him as opposed to run stuff through him. I think he's more valuable right now as a playmaker and as a space creator than he is as a go-to scorer. I don't necessarily want to drop the ball into the post to Marc Gasol and have him back a guy down or sort of work around and give me a spin around, turn around jumper from 10, 12, 15 feet or back his way down to the rim and try and, you know, lay it up or dunk on a guy. I think the Raptors have more flow to their offense, a little more athleticism, and I think certainly a lot of perimeter. In today's game, the Raptors are just as guilty of it or just as, I don't know if guilty is the right word, they do it just as much. So I think even having Gasol out on the perimeter, spotting up, you know, for a open as a shooter when Siakam drives and opposing teams try to cut him off and he's forced to pass out. I think Gasol is more valuable as a shooter away from the rim or as a guy, again, it's almost as a decoy, as a spot-up guy, as opposed to running stuff to him specifically. That might change if the absence is extended for Lowry and or Ibaka and you simply need more scoring options. But right now, I think the Raptors are proving most nights they've got enough scoring, whether they're getting 8 or 10 or 12 from Gasol. They've still got enough, even in the absence of Lowry and Ibaka, but they don't have to have Gasol sort of being that guy again like he was perhaps 5-10 years ago.
Eric, we're going to let you run. Great of you to do this. Have a safe flight to Portland. I know it's one of your favorite cities. Enjoy it, and we shall chat.
Anytime, guys. Thanks.
Take care.
Hit the food trucks up, Eric.
Oh, yes. Portland's a wonderful city.
It's so great.
Portland is one of the I wouldn't even call it a hidden gem anymore because most people pretty much get it. The Houston Astros, in case you joined us a little late, the Houston Astros have been accused of using of electronic sign stealing or using electronics to steal signs in 2017.
Quite an 8 weeks for the Astros, huh?
Quite an eight weeks for the Astros.
Jesus.
You know, my first response is, you know, I was taking a look. There were at least 9 players in the 2017 Astros who were someplace else.
Ah.
So my response was, all right, if that's the case, why haven't the players talked about it? Well, apparently Mike Fiers has talked about it to Ken Rosenthal and Evan Drellich of Drellich of The Athletic. And Richard and myself are going to talk about that. We'll get Shai Davidi on later on to chat about it as well. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Maestro. Yo, brothers ain't seen what I've seen in this game, son. Been in this game a long, long, long time. Since driving, though. I'm filled with Israelites, Rastafarians, God bodies, FOI, Sunni Muslims, T.O. to Brooklyn, many nights in Bed-Stuy, blazing trees out in Cali.
Welcome back to Writer's Block. I'm sorry, Derek Brandao and myself are having a dispute about music off air. It's just our traditional Winnipeg versus Toronto music. I just wonder how come all the best Toronto artists are guys that have to, like, lift stuff from other people, right? Sample stuff. You ever wonder that?
Can't say I've wondered a lot of
it. No, you really don't care about that.
Yeah, no.
We'll be joined, hopefully, later on in the show by Shai Davidi of Sportsnet. He is at the general manager's meetings in Scottsdale, Arizona. Lots of talk at the GM meetings today about a story in The Athletic, Ken Rosenthal and Evan Drellich, reporting that the Houston Astros used electronic equipment to steal catcher signs and convey information in 2017. Now, look, there isn't a team in baseball that hasn't been accused of this. Folks in Toronto will remember the infamous Man in White. And various teams claim there was a guy wearing white in center field who was helping out Blue Jays hitters. nobody noticed at the time that the Blue Jays' batting average on the road was actually better than at home. But anyhow, this is something that's gone on. Joe Kerrigan, when he was the Boston Red Sox pitching coach, absolutely swore that there was a camera in center field at the Rogers Center and signs were being stolen. And the issue's always been the how do you steal signs and relay it to hitters in time so that they can react before the pitch? Well, this latest story probably wouldn't have any legs. You'd probably just put it in another urban myth category were it not for the fact that a pitcher with the Houston Astros at that time, Mike Fiers, is essentially he's supporting this.
He's telling you how it happened.
He's exactly saying how it happened. A couple of things to keep in mind about the Astros, and I know we're up against it here, but the Astros, of course, had an employee kicked out of the area around the Boston Red Sox dugout, allegedly during the postseason using electronic devices. We know the Astros organization has been under a lot of scrutiny lately, so this is just another sort of installment in the unraveling, I would say, of the Astros' reputation. We'll talk about that later on. And Joe Van Buha, Clippers beat writer with The Athletic, joins us. It's Writer's Block on 590 and 360. Sorry. Okay. All right. Sorry, I was thinking. I was thinking of our old clock. The out was 52. So we can continue talking about.
I love
that
the fact that everybody but behind the glass is laughing at us.
The idea is that Mike Fiers, who pitched for the Houston Astros, is lending his support to this. And then you read further on. Danny Farquhar was with the Chicago White Sox. This is actually kind of funny talking about. There was a banging from the dugout, almost like a bat hitting the bat rack. Every time a changeup signal got put down. So, I mean, this is one of those things, Richard, where guys, like, baseball people talk, right? Baseball people talk all the time. But this is fascinating because there is a lot of detail in here that you don't normally get.
Yeah, so the allegations are like to the effect of the Astros, they're alleging that the Astros figured out a way to get the sign from the catcher, some kind of video or some kind of camera, like in center field or in the outfield.
Mm-hmm.
It's played in the dugout somewhere or in the clubhouse somewhere. Team officials are able to decode or decipher what the pitch is. And then somebody in the dugout, Jeff, is banging like a bat against a trash can for a changeup or an off-speed pitch. Obviously, you can't probably do it with fastball, but you can do that with off-speed. And Mike Fiers basically is saying, like, this happened and this is true. What's really interesting about this story is, one, is it really cheating? I know Major League Baseball has said it is, but it gets into the larger, like, you know.
Players have been stealing signs.
Yeah, like, are you just
years.
Sort of, are the Astros just ahead in terms of their ability to sort of beat the system or beat the game? And then the second one is, and this was interesting in Ken Rosenthal and Evan's reporting, was some guys didn't use it and others did. Like, there are some players who don't want to know what's coming. Some do.
Kevin Barker's been very clear about that. There are guys who don't want to know.
But Farquhar said, and this was really interesting to me really quick, was that young pitchers who don't know anything about this, totally getting screwed, couldn't understand why their off-speed pitches were getting hit.
Yeah, and you know, there's another aspect to this as well. We'll talk about with Shai. You don't have to do it all the time for it to be effective. You can just do it at certain spots in the game. You can sometimes not do it at all during games. So it's not necessarily that it's been done every day, but it's at specific times. We'll talk about that with Shai Davidi at some point because I hear the music playing. That means I can take my break now. I never forget the old clock. You never forget your first, Deitch. You never forget your first. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and Sportsnet 360.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher.
Do not settle. Demand.
Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. When you choose to work with a deadline for your entire working life, you gotta be a little bit crazy. And crazy is great radio. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
let's see if this works this time. It's Writer's Block with Blair and Deitch. You're not here Friday, right? We got Donovan Bennett Friday.
Upgrade. Yes, I'm not here Friday.
All right. What are you doing? Can you tell us?
Yeah, I have just childcare duties that I could not get out of, and so I had to take a what do you guys call it? PTO? What do you call personal vacation days?
PTO isn't that like one of those tryouts at NFL?
Personal time off.
Yeah.
We call that somewhere. Yeah, so that's the I'm not going anywhere. I had to
kids somewhere if you wanted.
I mean, I guess in theory I could have probably just plopped them up behind us, but
take them to a movie.
What should I take him to see?
What? Oh, the
Frozen?
Is the Dora the Explorer movie.
Is that out right now?
Yeah.
I don't know. They might be a little too young for that. But we were thinking about going to Frozen. That's coming out. Frozen 2, I should say. It's coming out pretty soon. We may have to
Frozen 2?
Check that out.
Frozen, that movie scared me.
Did you watch it?
No. Just the concept of it scares
me. It's actually really, for an animated film, and I'm not the biggest animated film fan, it's really well done. A lot of stars in that film. My God,
you could take him to see Ford versus Ferrari.
I've seen the trailer on that. Boy, that looks horrible. You think it looks good?
I think it looks great.
Oh,
I think it looks spectacular. Look at Brandeo's nodding. You like it?
No, Brandeo's
now he's shaking his head.
It's terrible. It's awful. I should ask Brandeo what he thinks of the.
Anyhow, Travis McKenzie gave it the thumbs up. You've seen it, right? Hmm. Why were you giving it the thumbs up? Anyhow.
No. I'm taking it
for ice cream, especially if it's really cold.
I might do that.
That's always a good thing to do.
My daughter loves popcorn. She's kind of obsessed with it for like a little kid.
Yeah, that's good. You ever get her the pink stuff? Like, do you remember that pink elephant popcorn that had the pink food coloring and the sugar on it?
Let me ask you this. And on a similar point, like, why do people like cotton candy?
What?
It is gross.
Because it's spectacularly good.
Blair, you're out of your mind. It is gross.
It is spectacularly good.
You like corn dogs?
No.
All right. You draw the line somewhere.
Well, that leaves yourself open to a one-liner if you say yes. Cotton candy's spectacular.
I bet horrible.
Are you a communist?
It's like eating candy corn. It just makes you sick at a certain point.
I bet you don't like candied apples either.
No, I wouldn't eat a candied apple. Love Kit Kats, though. It's delicious.
What are you, a dentist kid? Anyhow.
All right.
We'll have to do, because God knows, sports talk radio, nobody's ever done a segment on candies or stuff like that.
That's right.
We'll have to do it.
Apologies for those of you waiting for the Clippers talk. We'll get to it.
We're getting to it right now. Jovan Buha covers the Clippers for The Athletic, and he joins Richard Deitch and myself in Writer's Block. Jovan, I'm sorry you had to hear that. Generally, we're better, but it's been a bad day. I've been screwing up the time clock. I'm still awaiting my coffee, so it's a little ragged today. It's a little ragged today. I apologize.
It's all good.
Yeah, like Kawhi yesterday. It's not perfect, but we'll try to get the W.
what did you make of Kawhi's game last night? And were you surprised that the Raptors? Look, I would think Kawhi probably figured out, taking a look at the Raptors and the lineup they were going to have, that the plan of attack was probably going to be, I don't know if he thought they'd necessarily be to quadruple team him, but that they were going to try to take him out of the game. That was really the only option Nick Nurse had. What did you make of Kawhi's game last night?
Yeah, I thought that might have been his worst game of the season. And even despite that, he still almost had a triple-double. But the 2-11 shooting was his worst shooting performance of the season. Only 12 points, 9 turnovers. But, you know, to your point, they were double, triple, and even quadruple teaming him. And I think the biggest thing we've seen from Kawhi this season as far as kind of a surprising development has been his playmaking. You know, he's averaging a career high, I believe 5.9 assists, you know, just under 6. That's been in that 7 to 8 range for most of the season. It's kind of dipped down the last couple of games, but you know, it's something Doc has talked about, that he really developed last postseason with the Raptors, starting in the semifinals against the Sixers, where just the way defenses started to cover him, they're forcing the ball out of his hands, and he really showed a level of playmaking he had never showed in San Antonio. So I think you saw some of that last night with. You know, he had a couple of nice bullet passes to Mo Harkless for dunks and just finding guys in the pick and roll. And, you know, I think kind of saw that on display. Now, the shooting, well, it was pretty bad, and it's been bad the last few days. Kind of coincidentally, since the kind of load management stuff has really become the topic du jour, he's kind of struggled, you know, after it came out that he had this knee injury. So I thought that's been a little interesting. But, yeah, I mean, kind of to your point, like, the Raptors were going to defend him that way. They did a really good job. It almost worked. You know, as Nick Nurse said, you know, it seemed like they kind of outplayed the Clippers, but ultimately the Clippers got the W.
You know, it's interesting you talk about his assist, because we talked a little bit about it yesterday, and I said, you know, if you look at the numbers in the postseason last year, I think he had like 90, Kawhi had 94 assists, but he had almost half of them in the final eight games, you know, to Doc's point about him becoming a little more of a facilitator. And clearly early in this season, his assist numbers, you know, are up, especially in the first four games. I thought it was almost to the point where he was thinking pass first and shoot second. Jovan, do you know, and has Doc said what he kind of considers to be a nice balance for Kawhi in a game? Like, does he have a number in terms of assists versus points that he would like to see from Kawhi? Because I know Nick Nurse was really big on that with some of his players. I mean, he's always said that you can tell the type of night Kyle Lowry's had by looking at his assist to point, you know, ratio.
No, he hasn't mentioned any particular figures. Like, I would, even with him averaging the career high, like, you know, 5.9 assists, he's averaging also a career high 26.9 points per game. So,
right.
We've actually kind of seen the best of both worlds with Kawhi, where you know, he's posting a career high usage rate of about 37%, which I think his previous high was around like 31%. So we've just never seen him handle the ball this much, and I think that comes down to the Clippers just not really having a traditional point guard. And it's something Kawhi talked about. He's like, in Toronto, I had Kyle Lowry; San Antonio, I had Tony Parker. You know, we had these kind of system offenses. But with the Clippers, especially these first 10 games without Paul George, it's just been a lot of, you know, Kawhi isolation, Kawhi post-up, Kawhi pick and roll. So they've almost used him as kind of like that LeBron James, you know, point forward out there. And I think that's why you've seen it kind of correlate to him. You know, his shooting numbers have dipped. So, you know, it's probably, I think it's his lowest shooting percentage, you know, since like his rookie season or his, you know, second year. But outside of that, like all of his kind of offensive numbers are at career best levels. And I think it's really just because the Clippers, the way their offense is, the way the team's kind of structured, you know, Lou Williams, Pat Beverly, like those aren't traditional point guard types. So they're really, you know, running the ball through Kawhi. And I don't think that's going to change when Paul George comes. If anything, I think they're going to continue to kind of use Paul like off the ball and, you know, have him come off pin downs and spot ups and different stuff. So I think this is, you know, for the season, Kawhi is going to be the primary playmaker unless they make a trade for a point guard, which I don't really see happening with kind of the way the roster is. So I think this is deliberate, but as far as like some type of balance, and, you know, I think Doc doesn't want him taking 30 shots a night. Like he's already done a couple times, but you know, I think he thinks he just trusts Kawhi. And he said, like, you know, whatever Kawhi decides, I'm cool with.
Jovan, I wonder if you agree with my sort of thinking on this, and you'll have the perspective from Los Angeles. While the game against the Clippers this week was really of significant importance, I think, for Raptors fans in Toronto, and they were certainly interested, it felt like it was just another game for the Clippers. It was just sort of another game on the schedule, where maybe that will be a little bit different December 11th when Kawhi comes to Toronto, yeah, which obviously is a massive game in this market. But did you get that sense? Last night's game felt far bigger or far more important for people, at least in our market, than it did at all in Los Angeles.
No, I totally agree with you. It did just feel like a normal game. You know, Doc, that was the way kind of Doc presented it pregame. You know, the Clippers didn't have shoot around, so we also didn't get that perspective from other players before the game to kind of see how they were feeling or kind of processing the situation. And if someone asked Doc pregame, you know, have you noticed the change in Kawhi's demeanor, you know, heading into this game? And then Doc, you know, retorted, well, have you ever noticed the change in Kawhi's demeanor? And then, you know, the media room erupted in laughter, and then there was a pause, and then he's like, exactly, you know, like, neither have I. So, Doc, I mean, I think that was kind of deliberate on the Clippers' part, where, you know, with some of this load management stuff, they haven't been getting the best press lately, and I think they kind of wanted to downplay this and not make it a big deal. I know Kawhi talked about it a little bit after the game, but it seemed like he kind of downplayed it too. So I almost feel like they're kind of feeding off of Kawhi's personality, where maybe if it was a more, or if it wasn't as harmonious of a breakup and kind of, if things ended on sour terms or Kawhi was a more outspoken figure, you would have maybe seen some more bad blood or just more kind of intensity from Clippers fans last night. But to them, it was just another game. It was just watching Kawhi play, the Raptors. But I do think that you could tell from the Raptors fans in attendance, which there were a lot of them, that kind of ratcheted up the energy in the arena, where the Clippers fans, and this has really been a thing ongoing for, Clippers games for years now, is, they'll have, a few thousand fans from the opposing fan base, and that kind of almost forces Clipper fans to match the energy. Like you saw that on opening night against the Lakers. It was pretty close to 50-50 going back and forth. And, it wasn't quite that even last night, but the Raptors fans were loud, and they made the Clippers fans kind of have to step up and match their intensity. So that was definitely something that was interesting with that atmosphere of just how many Raptors fans were there.
Yeah, when we had Rex Kalanian on yesterday, who's really always really great to talk to, and people know him from this market, and he discussed how the players on the Clippers have really bought into what Doc is selling, bought into Doc's system. And I wonder, from your perspective, how do you think Paul George is going to fit in when he comes back? Because if you think about it just in basketball terms, it's scary. I mean, yesterday they doubled Kawhi. He kicks out to an open shooter, and, that shooter will hit it or won't. But kicking out to Paul George, to me, is an entirely different proposition for opposing teams.
Yeah, no, I think Paul is going to change everything. Like, I just tweeted about this, actually. Like, they're 7-3 right now, 7-1 when Kawhi plays. But they've quietly have the best defense in the league over the last 2 weeks after really struggling in their first few games. They have the fifth best net rating in the league right now. And they're doing all this without Paul George, who finished third in MVP and third in Defensive Player of the Year last year. So, adding that type of guy, a clear top 10 guy, in my opinion, to this team, like, they already look like a championship contender without him. But when you add him, I think that's why so many people have them as the favorites. It's just because of that combination of the depth and the star power at the top. Like, I think if you compare the Clippers to other contenders around the league, sure, maybe LeBron and AD are the better star duo, but the Lakers are not as deep as the Clippers are. Like, the Clippers legitimately can now throw out, once Paul is back, a really good starting lineup, which is already one of the best lineups in the league without him. That's going to get better once he returns. And then they have one of the best benches, if not the best bench in the league, with Lou Williams, Montrezl Harrell. They'll probably move Landry Shamet to the bench once he's back from his ankle sprain. A guy like DeMichael Green coming off the bench. So this team is absolutely loaded, 1 through 10, 1 through 11. They have two top 10 guys. Like, that's as good of a championship recipe as any. So I think Paul, once he's back, they're going to have to redistribute the minutes. I think Lou Williams will have to take a step back, whether that's potentially not closing some games, taking less shots, scoring less. Montrezl Harrell can also be someone who's a little bit affected by that. But, I think it's kind of almost nice timing for them that Landry Shamet just got injured now. He'll probably be out for a few weeks, and that'll kind of ease that process of reacclimating Paul into the rotation. But, look, it's a great problem to have, having too many guys, having too much depth. You will always take that over having, a seven-man rotation or something. So I'm just, as someone who covers this team, intrigued to see kind of how this all shakes out. But I do think that, they've gotten off to a great start already. And Paul, it's hard to see how he would hurt them on either end with the way he played last season.
Jovan Buha joins us on Writer's Block. As you look around that conference, how would you... Where would you position the Clippers right now? I mean, clearly, from a distance, they look, we think that they're one of the, if not the best team in the league. How do you see the rest of that conference shaking out, though? Who's the team to keep an eye on in the West?
I'm going to go cliche here, but I think it's the Lakers. And you saw it opening night, and that was one of, ended up being one of their worst games of the season that they ended up, losing them as in the Lakers. That team is so good defensively. The Clippers have been the best defense for the last 2 weeks, but the team right behind them is the Lakers, who've been the best defense pretty much all season. So I think that team has really figured it out. They're still trying to figure out how to integrate Kuzma into the rotation. But with AD and LeBron, you know, arguably two top five guys in the league, that's as good as it gets if that team could stay healthy and maybe add another piece like Andre Iguodala. I do think it's kind of starting to show in the numbers. Like, there is a gap, I think, between the two LA teams and the rest of the West. I don't know how big that gap is at the top. You know, it might be a small one, but I do think it's kind of, you know, the two LA teams and probably that tier of, like, Denver, Utah, Houston.
Right.
You know, I think Portland's kind of dropped. You know, San Antonio's dropped a bit. Golden State, obviously. Houston, their defense has been a mess all season, and you know, now Eric Gordon's dealing with an injury that could have him out for a month plus. Denver, yeah, their coach called them out early in the season, but you know, I think they have the best record in the West right now, or tied with the Lakers. And then Utah's been kind of up and down. Mike Conley has really been inconsistent to start the season, and he was supposed to be their big additions. But you know, defensively, they're always going to be there. Rudy Gobert is so good. Donovan Mitchell is taking the next step. So I guess if I had to pick another team outside of the Lakers, I'd probably say the Jazz because of how good they are defensively. And I still think Conley and Mitchell can kind of figure things out on the offensive side. But to me, it kind of clearly is like the Lakers and then everybody else in the West with regards to the Clippers. And that being said, it's probably neck and neck with the Clippers and Lakers as far as who's the best team right now. I'd probably give the Clippers a slight edge just because they beat the Lakers on opening night and they're about to add Paul George. But you know, if you want to argue the Lakers, like I'm not really going to go back and forth. Like I think you can make the case either way. So to me, it's the two LA teams and everyone else in the West.
Yovan, last one for me. Can you explain to us why, even after this offseason, the Clippers don't seem to have a bigger slice of Los Angeles? I get the cliche that it's always going to be a Lakers town and quote unquote the same way like New York's always going to be a Yankees town. But, like, just from a basketball perspective, I don't really understand how a basketball fan couldn't appreciate this Clippers group. They do everything good, and they have star power.
Yeah, it's something that has always, you know, it's just always kind of bewildered me where, you know, even going back, I've been going to Clippers games, you know, covering the team for 8 years now. So, you know, starting with the first season of Lob City. So I've actually only covered, like, good Clippers basketball. And even back then, kind of at the height of Lob City, they just added Chris Paul, you know, Blake Griffin's this young star in the making. You know, it was still, I remember there was quotes after games against the Heat and LeBron or the Bulls, like, you know, that this feels like a road game. You know, why does our home games feel like a road game? And that's just always kind of been a thing with this team. And I think it's a couple of things. Like, the biggest thing is the cliche that you said of, you know, this is not only a Lakers town, but I think the Lakers really are the team of the town. You know, it's one thing to be the dominant team in the sport, but I do think, you know, not every person, but a majority of LA is a Lakers fan. And you grow up, you know, I grew up in this area, like, you know, everyone in my high school was a Lakers fan. You know, maybe 5% of them were Clippers fans. So it's like, it's just been so ingrained for decades where, you know, the Lakers, I just think, are on a different level where they're not even competing with the Clippers or the Knicks or the Celtics. Like, I think the Lakers are competing with the Yankees and the Cowboys for the team of America and
right.
the Patriots or whatever. So, like, they're really at that level where, you know, when you factor in the NBA's global presence and impact, like, the Lakers might be the most famous American team in sports, period. You know, so, like, comparing them to the Lakers is never going to be a fair fight, even if they won the next five championships. Like, it doesn't matter. Now, I do think that it's maybe not as you know, one-sided as the games might show. Like, I do think there are a lot of Clippers fans who just might not go to games, you know, be able to afford tickets. Like, you know, a big branding thing for them has been really, you know, appealing to the blue-collar working class. And, you know, they have this new ticket promotion this year with their sponsor, Honey, where they have these $10 tickets that, you know, Pat Beverly helped set up. And I think that's kind of a way to reach out to the community and kind of get more fans in that might not be able to get to games that might be Clipper fans that just aren't represented. So I think they're trying to work on that. They're you know, working on their brand. And I think they've just been so incompetent for so long that even this one kind of decade stretch of you know, good basketball, which half of it was under Sterling, so that kind of also plays into this. You know, I think it's just going to take another decade or so for them to really reach where they probably should be. So I think, you know, this is a long process. They were terrible for 30 years. They've been good now for 8-9 years. But I think if we're talking in 2029 and having this conversation, I think it is going to look different. Even if the Lakers win a couple of championships over the next decade, like, I just think this takes time. It's systemic. You know, the Lakers have been great for, you know, 40, 50 years out here. Clippers have been bad for 30 years. And, you know, 3 years doesn't really change that. I think it's going to have to take another generation or two for it to really shift.
Yo, man, it's great of you to join us. Thanks so much. Terrific insight.
Appreciate it, guys.
Take care. That's Jovan Buha, covers the Clippers for The Athletic. And again, the Raptors falling 98-88 to Kawhi Leonard and the Clippers last night. Baseball's general managers are meeting in Scottsdale. Lots to talk about. The Jays apparently making contact with some free agents. And the Houston Astros being accused of cheating. It's been a great, great, great fall for the Astros. It really has been. Shai Davidi joins us from Scottsdale. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590. The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
Amy Trask is our regular NFL insider. She will join us at 4:30. Elliot Friedman of Hockey Night in Canada and the NHL Sportsnet will be along at 4 o'clock. Interesting story. Dejan Vasevich of Pittsburgh Sports Report, formerly of the Pittsburgh
Post-Gazette, maybe?
Post-Gazette.
Yeah, or Tribune.
Reporting that Sidney Crosby apparently is seeing a core specialist in Philadelphia. Sidney Crosby left the game with a lower body injury. Left this weekend, a game this weekend with a lower body injury. So we'll talk to Elliot about that and see if there's any update on that as well. Again, Elliot Friedman joining us at 3 o'clock. Major League Baseball general managers are gathered in Scottsdale, Arizona for their annual meetings, a precursor to the winter meetings, which are going to be held in San Diego next month. And from all appearances, it seems as if the first thing you do now if you're a general manager at these meetings is you have your room swept for bugs in case the Houston Astros are listening in. Shai Davidi's our MLB insider with Sportsnet. He joins us from Scottsdale. Shai, thanks so much for joining us. Of course, a lot of chatter today about the Athletic story that the Houston Astros were using electronic sign or electronic devices to steal catchers and catcher signs and banging on garbage cans to relay information. You know what I was going to say? Normally, I'd just look at this, roll my eyes, and go urban myth. You know, it's like the man in white and the old camera that was allegedly in center field at the Rogers Center. But when you have players attaching their names to it, that gets my attention awfully quickly. I'm just wondering what fallout there has been in Scottsdale, if any, that you've been able to determine so far from this story.
Well, not yet, but I'm sure there's going to be some really intriguing stuff that's going to come out when the general managers meet with us in about an hour and a half. All the GMs will be in one room, and I'm sure there's going to be quite the gathering around the Houston Astros GM, Jeff Luhnow. But look, I mean, we've been talking, you know, to a degree about the paranoia in the game around this issue and how it's, you know, led to some slowdowns in the game, all the catchers meetings that we've seen in recent years. And, you know, when Mike Fiers attaches his name to it, I mean, it actually makes it really real. And you suddenly you're saying to yourself, okay, well now, you know, some of the paranoia makes sense. And I just think it's really interesting that somebody would actually attach his name to this, because it demonstrates a desire to sort of get this out of the game. And also to a degree about how out of control it has become in the game.
Shai, I'm fascinated by the story for many reasons. But one of the reasons is the schadenfreude. I never can get that word out enough. The schadenfreude when it comes to the Astros.
Schadenfreude, not shot, not Marty.
What did I say?
Hard shot. You said schadenfreude.
How should I pronounce it?
Schadenfreude.
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 I concede to my German co-host to the right. So, Shai, like, what the parallels with the Astros and the Patriots to me are fascinating in that they're polarizing. There's a big group of people within each of the games that hate them, and I think they take a lot of pleasure when these stories come out. And so, again, I am sure other teams do it, but do you get the impression that there's just, I don't know, there's more people who'd be willing to sort of push this when it comes to the Astros because of many reasons, jealousy, dislike, et cetera?
Well, I mean, there's definitely dislike, and that's been the case for a lot of years. I remember talking to a GM one year at the GM meetings. You know, they have breakout groups and they put teams together. And one of the general managers who was grouped with the Houston Astros said, "He's like, I don't know if that says something about what the other GMs think of me right now that I'm getting paired with the Houston Astros." So I mean, it's a little indication of some of the feeling towards them. But you know, they have been leaders in technology in many ways, and on the player development side and some of the things they've done in terms of pitching, some of the things they've done with their hitters, they've really driven the bus in terms of some of the advances that have taken place within the game. And if you sort of take a step back with it, it would make sense that they'd sort of lead the way in advancing cheating as well, which seems to be the case. And so for those reasons, the fact that they're good, the fact that they like to talk about how they're good, the fact that they've kind of lorded it around on people. I do think that there is a degree of Schadenfreude around what's happening with them. And also a degree of people just thinking, you know, you're kind of getting what you deserve in a sense, too. Mm.
Well, I was going to say, though, I'm going to rise to the defense of the Astros a little bit here in that if any team would have reason to be paranoid, it's Houston. I mean, they did have their player development system hacked by the St. Louis Cardinals, or their player information system hacked by the St. Louis Cardinals. And yes, we do know that the story of Kyle MacLachlan, you know, standing beside the Red Sox, I think it was the Red Sox or Yankees dugout during the postseason. But the Astros have also claimed for a while that they thought people have been not spying on them, but have been trying to intercept their signals. I guess, you know, you're right, though, Shai. The fact that you have a player, or in this case a pitcher, speaking about this openly now, in the very least, Rob Manfred has to take this seriously, because if you read Mike Fiers' comments, you know, and I don't know Mike Fiers, but I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt here. He's making a case that this is having a negative impact on some careers. Never mind that we can view it as cheating. It's having a negative impact on some careers. And I think the thing that's really people need to remember about this is it doesn't mean they're doing it every second of every game. That's not the point. You can be judicious when you do this stuff.
Right, exactly. And, you know, if you're too obvious and too overt, then people are going to find it out. But it's interesting when you think that somebody has crossed a line, and clearly there are some people who think that this has gone too far. Look, sign stealing has been part of the game forever, right? And, you know, if you're at second base and you're not trying to steal signs, you're not doing your job.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that when you start getting into tech, and when you're hiring people or using your base operations people to try and steal things, steal signs from a distance and try to figure this stuff out, I mean, that's not fair game, because it's not what's really happening on the field of play. And to me, that is why this has become an issue, and why you have some players who are clearly rejecting it, because they see that as a violation of what's supposed to be taking place and sort of the right way to do things. And maybe they're in the minority, maybe they're not, but this is something, you know, I mean, you mentioned the fact when the Astros database got hacked, you know, this would be sort of another example of, you know, corporate espionage essentially being transferred into sports, into baseball. And, you know, the front offices, the way players are evaluated, the way teams are constructed has all moved into this corporate realm. You know, is this part of what you want to bring into your game as well? You know, this really negative, and it's a nefarious, corrosive element of the corporate world do you want that being imported as well?
Yeah, I'm just the MLB Network, and I have not seen the release yet, but it seems as if Major League Baseball is saying that that they are investigating this situation and will take further action if necessary. Now, again, that's I'm just reading a statement right off the TV set as you were talking. So, sorry, Richard, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt there.
Yeah, that's okay. Shai, I wanted to ask you a question about the Jays brass in terms of making their pitch to free agents and specifically pitchers. Twofold. One, how aggressive will they be? And secondly, what will the pitch be? If I'm an agent of a I don't even sort of want to throw some Zach Wheeler. I realize that's probably not going to be the guy, but let's say I'm Zach Wheeler's agent, and it's Ross Atkins or Mark Shapiro. What's the pitch? What are they going to try to? How are they going to sell me on considering Toronto?
That's interesting because I asked Ross Atkins precisely that question last night, and you know the basis of it is like, look, we're young, we've got financial flexibility, we've got depth. We've got the ability to compete. We've got a manager, Charlie Montoyo, that's creating a positive environment. You know, that's the sort of the Coles notes of it, or the elevator pitch of it. But ultimately, look, you're getting this done based on money in the end, right? If you're 98% of the time when you're dealing with a free agent, you need to be the high bid. And that's really what it's going to come down to for the Blue Jays. Are they willing to be the high bid on some of these guys? And you know, they've been talking to a lot of free agents, and the sense that, you know, the thing that Ben Nicholson, Smith, and I keep hearing is that the Blue Jays seem to be more engaged than they have been in previous off seasons. But, you know, it's one thing to get close. It's being there at the finish line and being willing to maybe give that year that you don't want to, or spend that extra few dollars that you don't want to get a deal done. So that's ultimately where the test is going to be. But, you know, I think, look, they're in a situation where they're going to need someone to look at the roster and say, hey, I believe in this group. I think I can make a difference, and I want to compete in the American League East. And then when you have that, then you're going to need the money to be there.
Mm. Is it your sense that the Blue Jays are going to kick the tires as well as starting pitching, but are going to kick the tires in some position players, you know, specifically – I don't know specifically, but somebody like a Marcell Ozuna or Jose Abreu or Mike Moustakas. Jose Abreu may be a bad example, but a Moustakas or an Ozuna.
I think that, you know, Moustakas to me makes a ton of sense for the Blue Jays. You know, Ozuna, you know, impact offensive player. But, you know, if I'm looking at the way this team is set up right now, and Moustakas is a guy who can play first, can play third, can play second, left-handed bat, grinder, a guy who's, from all accounts, is a really positive presence in the clubhouse, leader, all that kind of stuff. I think that would make a ton of sense for the Blue Jays, and a left-handed bat as well to bring some balance to the lineup. So, you know, to me, he checks sort of all the boxes that you want right now. But again, you know, it's a Scott Boras client and somebody who's been tethered to qualifying offer in the past two off seasons, and now is free of that. He's got a chance to really be a legitimate free agent. We'll see how that changes things.
Do we know for certain that the Blue Jays, that the qualifying offer would not prevent the Blue Jays from going after a free agent? You know, in other words, that they won't automatically avoid a guy just because there'd be compensation attached to it. Do we know for certain that they've kind of taken that step? I'm going to say a step forward this off season.
Well, a couple of times that Ross Atkins this offseason already said that the Blue Jays aren't going to let that stop them.
Okay.
But the fact is they're going to factor it into the price when you're dealing with the free agent. So does that ultimately negate any sort of advantage that you have or prevent the free agent from saying, okay, well, you know, you're taking that away from me. I don't want to sign here. I want to go somewhere else. That could be the case. So, you know, yeah, I think under the right circumstances, they would do it. Even though they'd be giving up a pick around 45 in the draft at plus $500,000 in international bonus cap room. But I think ultimately that, you know, the fact that they'll factor that in the price probably takes them to a degree out of that market.
Shai, what is your best guess for the budget for 2020? And where would that, where would your guess rank within Major League Baseball compared to the other clubs?
Interesting. I'm not sure exactly where it would rank right now. I'd have to sort of look at, you know, probably be the middle tier-ish. But I would think that they've got about 60, 65 on the books once you factor in arbitration players and 0-3 service time players. And, you know, I would think that they would have at least 40 to 50 to spend if they wanted to this winter. So, you know, they've certainly got an ability to do a lot of things and to make some things happen. And, you know, I think what the Blue Jays have generally done under this regime is sort of spread the wealth around and try to sort of diversify your spend. And, you know, maybe this is a offseason where rather than try to get, you know, like, you know, five or six guys in, you know, the $5 to $10 million range, is that you spend a little bit more aggressively and get two or three guys at the higher end of the scale.
Have you been able to get a read yet on where Ben Cherington stands in the in the Pittsburgh Pirates general manager's hunt?
Well, I was talking to a couple people from other organizations last night, and you know, their sense was that Ben Cherington might be the favorite for that job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at this point, who knows? He doesn't. We haven't seen him here, so it stands to reason that he's not here right now. So
right.
You know, that could very well be the Blue Jays just saying, hey, you know, just figure this out. You don't want to have to deal with that while you're trying to work here. So stay home, and we'll handle it while that gets sorted. But you know, you put all those pieces together, he's obviously in the mix there to this point and getting some serious consideration.
Sure. I just want to bring this up because we talked to you so much about this in March and April of this year. And now at the end of the year, the American League Rookie of the Year is Alvarez, followed by John Means and Brandon Lowe. So Vladdy Guerrero Jr., who I think many of us probably would have put money on.
He didn't even finish. Kevin Biggio finished ahead of him.
Finished ahead of him, right?
Yeah.
And was Bichette eligible or no?
He was eligible, but he just didn't have enough.
Yeah. Didn't have enough at bats.
He just didn't have enough at bats to get in there, yeah.
So this, you know, Shai, just in terms of, you know, how much we talked about March and April, that this ends up being the top three with Novolati in there.
Yeah, really interesting, because obviously you would have thought that he's going to be a favorite for it going into the season. And I just think, you know, you take a step back and you think about all the everything that was just being asked of him. And he obviously needed the big leagues to show him what he didn't know. And that's what happened. And he was, you know, everyone expected him to come in and hit right away. And it didn't happen for a portion of the time, especially in the beginning. He was essentially an island in that lineup and there was no reason to pitch to him. And for an extended period, you know, you look at what he was seeing and basically he was getting nothing in a hittable area. So he had very little to work with. But I think, you know, based on expectations, based on where he was coming in, you know, that's a disappointment for the Blue Jays. And, you know, I think the fact that he's made that commitment to work on himself this offseason speaks to what he's learned, what the big leagues has showed him that he needs to do to have success. And certainly he's trying to change that into next season.
Shai, it was great of you to do this. Enjoy Scottsdale. And again, you know, sweep your room for bugs. You never know if the Houston Astros are listening in.
They are everywhere.
Check the garbage cans, too. And if you hear any banging in your room or outside your room, you know something's up.
It means a change-up coming. Change-up coming, Shai.
Take care.
That's it. Be well, guys.
All right. Shai Davidi, our MLB insider. Again, Shai and Ben Nicholson-Smith are both at the general manager's meeting in Scottsdale, Arizona. So any breaking news, trust me, you'll find it first on sportsnet.ca or right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan or on TV on Sportsnet. We'll take a break. Mr. Deitch and myself will be back. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
How low can you go? Death row? What a brother, no. Once again, back is the incredible rhyme animal, the uncannable beast. Public enemy number one, 5 4 6 3.
All right, here's some news coming out of the general manager's meetings. Josh Donaldson in particular is apparently attracting a lot of attention. That's really no surprise. He talked to people around the game. They think Josh Donaldson, of course, former Blue Jay, who experienced a bit of a career rebirth in Atlanta, they think that Josh Donaldson may be one of the first free agents to sign. That Josh is the type of guy who, well, it's not that he's afraid of instability, but he likes to know where he's going to be early, get himself set up. And the teams that you're hearing right out of the gate are the Rangers, Phillies, Braves, and Nationals. To me, if you're the Washington Nationals, you got to make a decision in about another 2 weeks whether or not Anthony Rendon's going to be back. And if he's not coming back, you can't leave yourself exposed. You got to go right in on Josh Donaldson. And for the Washington Nationals, Josh Donaldson makes a certain amount of sense. He's not going to be looking for a 5 or 6 year contract rich. You can get him for 2 or 3 years, give him a high AAV, boom, you're set. And it seems to me it's a little bit like what the Jays went through with Edwin Encarnacion leaving when they jumped on the Kenrys Morales offer right away, or when they offered Kenrys Morales a deal right away. So, I've heard from a couple of people, one of them an agent, not Josh's agent, but that part of the scuttlebutt is they think Josh could go really early in the process. Any one of those teams, Rangers, Phillies, Braves, and Nationals, would be great for Josh. Obviously with the Braves, he screams Nationals.
I give Josh a lot of credit. It's sort of a Fred VanVleet in himself. He bet on himself. He had an excellent year with the Braves, turnaround year. And now he set himself up for, I think, a really nice contract, not short term, but a really nice contract with one of these teams. And I agree with you. If the Nationals lose Rendon, that's a pretty nice fit. I know he's not Rendon, but that still puts you, Jeff, obviously, depending on what happens with Strasburg, in a really good position next year.
Yeah. And, you know, you could also make the case that for Josh Donaldson, he may be a lot of teams' plan B. In other words, in addition to the Washington Nationals, any team that goes after Anthony Rendon, and we're led to believe there could be 8 or 10 of those teams, Josh would probably be plan B. So you could make the argument that perhaps it would be in Josh's best interest to wait. But my understanding from people is that Josh could be one of the first free agents to go, and that he'll go early. He's, and again, that would be in keeping with him.
California guy? Is that where he?
No, he's from Alabama.
Okay, so then that part of the country, eastern part of the country, makes sense. He's going to be an excellent addition for somebody, and I like Nationals would be a really good fit if they lose Rendon.
Yeah, I think it'd be a it'd be a smart move. I mean, the one problem the Nationals have is they're a National League team, so you can't use them as a DH.
Good point.
So you've got to, if you're going to get Josh Donaldson, you pretty much have to pencil him in as your starting third baseman. Elliot Friedman of Hockey Night in Canada is next. The Leafs, they're back on the ice tomorrow night against the New York Islanders. John Tavares returning to the island. They made a couple of player moves today. Michael Hutchinson cleared waivers. He will not be their backup goaltender. We'll talk to Elliot about that. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Expanding on all of the top sports headlines, this is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Kind of cold, Deitch. I'm like wearing. I just realized I'm wearing my
cold
vest.
Outside.
I'm wearing a winter vest inside.
Nice.
What the hell's up with that?
I saw that the snowfall was the heaviest in this city in 70 years or something crazy like that. Did you see that?
No.
Climate change, man. It's real. Anyway, good to be with you in the 4 o'clock hour, Jeff.
Always snows in Canada. Have you figured out the answer to my question that I asked you yesterday?
Which was what?
Is November the last month of fall or the first month of winter?
Well, in 2019, it is the first month of winter.
Okay.
Traditionally, it is the last month of fall.
Yeah.
We've been screwed here in Toronto with not getting late fall.
Right. I'm going to ask Elliot Friedman this and see what he says. I'm just interested in Maybe we should do a writer's block poll on this.
I'm sure Fried just talked to three sources on this.
Absolutely.
We'll find out. Lou Lamarillo, God, and climate change expert.
We'll find out what he says. Travis, do we have Elliot? Or you've got a frown in your face and you're pushing buttons. That would suggest that you probably pooched the transfer, correct, Mundo?
I'm just calling him from the line that doesn't have a delay.
Oh, that's good. Thanks, Travis. Thank you for doing that. That's good. Those delays are annoying. That's the worst thing. Amy Trask, by the way, no delay in this. Amy Trask at 4:40. Lots of NFL talk. Were you all in on the Niners before last night?
No, I actually.
Are you all in on the Niners now?
Yeah, I think they're legit. Right. Their defense is great, but to be honest with you, at the beginning of the year, I didn't see this at all. Yeah. I thought they'd be, you know, maybe at best like a 9-6 kind of team. I didn't. They're fantastic. They're much better than I expected. Seattle is better than I expected too.
Right.
I always seem to count the Seahawks out.
Okay.
Seems to be a mistake.
Anyway. Let's bring in Elliot Friedman of Hockey Night in Canada. And Elliot, I'm just going to ask you the same question I asked Deitch before we turn serious. November, first month of winter, last month of fall?
First month of winter.
Attaboy. Okay. Well, there you go. I think we're probably all on board with that. Elliot, it's been a, it's been a, I don't know if strange is the right word. It's been a complicated sort of topsy-turvy 72 hours around here. And, of course, Hockey Night in Canada as well, with the news that Don Cherry will no longer be on Coach's Corner. Look, you're someone who's a face in Hockey Night in Canada. You've been a face in Hockey Night in Canada for a long, long time. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you what you make of this.
Well, in some ways, Jeff, like I'm still in shock, really. I've been here like, 17 years. I can't imagine a show without Don, to be perfectly honest. He's the biggest personality I've ever worked with. I will work with nobody in my career who will have greater attention and his word carried more weight every week than what he said than Cherry. And it's, in a lot of ways, I can't even imagine what it's going to be like this weekend without him. I mean, there were a few of us watching together on Saturday. We were slack-jawed in amazement at what happened. And to me, the whole thing is sad. There's no winners. The aftershocks are going to continue for a long time. I felt horrible for the coworkers who were hurt by it. I felt horrible for the viewers who felt excluded or targeted. I watched the social media commentary going on right now. It's ugly. I feel horrible for the people who are being targeted by it. I feel for Ron, and I feel for any career to end this way. I always think there by the grace of God go I. And I just think the whole situation is awful, and I don't think that it's going to – the aftershocks are going to end for quite some time.
Mm. Elliot, Jeff and I discussed this yesterday for a long stretch. We had a round table with Arden Zwelling and Donovan Bennett on it. So we've covered a lot of sort of, I think, where we stand in terms of the comments, how we saw them, how we perceive them to reflect Canada or what our perception of Canada is. As someone who works on the show, though, I do want to ask you something that speaks to the show. How does it, and again, I realize that this is a fluid situation and many things will happen, but has there been any discussion yet as to what and how the show goes forward specific to that segment?
I believe there has, but I'm not in those conversations. And, you know, I think honestly, Richard, that this week is going to be hard enough on the people who run the show that they don't need me butting in and offering my opinion. I have told the people who are in charge whatever they need from me to help us get back on our feet again, I will do. I think that that's all you can offer in this situation. Be part of a team and try to make the team better. But I think the worst thing would be for me to interject myself and say, we should do this, or I think we should do this. I think people will have ideas, and if they need my opinions, they'll ask for them.
That's really well said, Elliot. And there's really no segue here, but I do want to move on and talk about the Toronto Maple Leafs. They are playing the Islanders tomorrow night. Before we do that, though, I don't know if you saw the report out of Pittsburgh about Sidney Crosby visiting a core specialist, which mm-hmm. I presume that's a doctor, physical trainer in Philadelphia. What are you hearing about the extent of his injury?
Well, I was a little bit surprised at that because, you know, I mean, like, I thought it was maybe the foot where he took the shot.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so now I'm kind of rewatching that whole play, that whole shift, and, you know, trying to kind of figure out he kind of hurtled himself a little bit before. Whenever you go see a core specialist on a play like that, you're wondering if there's like a groin or a doctor or something like that kind of injury that they're trying to deal with. So, you know, I mean, obviously those are I'm not exactly a physical specimen, but those are the core areas.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I kind of think that they're looking at something like that. I mean, it's obvious to me that the Penguins are trying to determine the length of this. When Malkin got hurt, there were a number of us who reported how long the injury might be, but the Penguins never came out with a timeline. So I think they're still trying to figure it out. And I don't know, though, when they're going to give us an idea of how long it is. It still sounds like they're trying to determine exactly how long it's going to be.
Elliot, from everything, both from what you've heard as well as your own analysis of this, we saw that Michael Hutchinson went through waivers, and the Leafs have now made their moves and brought up their goalie from the Marlies. How much of this will be a temporary solution, or how much of this may be the long-term solution?
Well, I think that it's an opportunity for him to show that he is good enough to at least try and take the job. You know, I've spent a lot of the last 24 to 48 hours kind of looking back at how this all unfolded. And, you know, I really believe when you go back to training camp, I think they were hoping that Neuwirth would be a solution for them. And when he, between the injury and it just, I don't know if it appeared as if his head was ever 100% into it, it kind of threw all the plans sideways. What I can tell you about the call-up is that, you know, I spoke to some teams who see the Leafs a lot. They said he took a huge jump last year in the playoffs. There wasn't much in the regular season last year that, you know, really impressed opponents about him. But in the playoffs, I believe they went to the Calder Cup semifinals. He was really good for them. And he's been pretty good for them this year on a team that started out pretty well. So is he a long-term solution, Rich? I don't think people would say yes, but I think they're more inclined to give him the benefit of the doubt in terms of what is available, in terms of his ability based on how he's done in his last 20 games or so.
Right, and I think in a way, you're almost obligated to give Cascasuo a chance, aren't you?
I think you want to reward your guys, right?
Right.
Like, I think there were I have no doubt that, you know, Sheldon Keefe, who coaches the Marlies, was happy to make that, to have that conversation and say, congratulations, you're getting your chance. I think there would be a lot of people in the organization who would be happy. I mean, I spent some time in the last couple of days looking at guys who make about $700K and who might make sense for the Maple Leafs. And, you know, there's some names out there. I mean, Stalock for Minnesota, he's got a couple of wins lately, although he's got term. Like, I think he's got another year on his contract. And, you know, the other one that kind of jumps out at me is Comrie, who was in Winnipeg but was claimed on waivers from Arizona. And they've got three goalies. They've got Kemper, they've got Comrie, they've got Ranta. And Arizona's made it clear that they're willing to make a move here. And but I don't know. I can't sense at this time the Maple Leafs have shown much interest.
So how did the Leafs survive a month without Mitch Marner?
Well, I mean, first of all, one man's injury is another man's opportunity, right? So Someone's got to come up and someone's got to do it. Look, he can't replace Marner. He's an elite level talent. He kills penalties for them. He's an offensive threat. I mean, for everything that him and the organization have been through in the last year, he's a really, really talented guy, and you're not going to replace him. But, you know, the one thing you can always say is this team should have enough offense. You know, I think the other thing, too, is it's going to force them to win games kind of like how they were winning them last week, like almost win ugly.
Mm-hmm.
And that could help them in the long term. I just think you have to ask guys to step up and take advantage of the opportunity. And you've got to be that much more dependable knowing that this talent's going to be out of the lineup.
Elliot, are we at the point yet where the coaching staff has to try to do something creative to get Tyson Barrie going? I know it's still quote-unquote early in the season, but, you know, you want to it's a little too dramatic, so you don't want to lose the guy for the year, but you do want to try to get that guy some positive momentum given his abilities, particularly offensively.
Yes, I agree with that. I'm surprised a little bit that especially when Riley was banged up, he didn't get more of a look on the first power play. I do think that, you know, the one thing I kind of feel for him is that it's his contract year, right?
Right.
And I do think at the end of the day, a rising tide floats all boats. And if the team does better, he'll do better. But, you know, it looks like it's going to be much more of a battle than it's been the last 2 years for the Maple Leafs in the regular season. And there's risks that come with that. I do see a team that is trying to change the way it plays a little bit. I think that affects everybody. But, you know, I look at Barrie right now, and I watched him answer a bunch of questions about it last Saturday morning against Philadelphia. And you can just see, and I don't think this should surprise anybody, but you should just see a guy who's really trying to hold back and be team about it. But you can see the frustration. And, you know, there's a lot on the line for him. It's a contract. It's his future. I could see any normal human worrying about that.
Elliot, I want to ask you about the Islanders. And, you know, it's at this point, like, they're not a fluke based on what we saw last year. And, you know, it goes without saying that organization just, like, totally signifies how important, like, a change in general manager, a change in coach, a change in culture can be. I mean, Trotz and Lamoriello have turned this thing around, I think, in relatively short amount of time. When you look at the Islanders, obviously given that the Leafs are going to play them, what impresses you about them? Because I think everything impresses them about me, from me.
Well, you know, I think one of the things where I remember talking to Thomas Greiss, who's one of their goalies before last season. And Thomas Greiss said that when he met Barrie Trotz asked him about, you know, what he would like to see, what he would like to see different. And Thomas Greiss said that he felt that there was no predictability defensively. Shots were coming from all over, good chances, things like that. And he said that Barrie Trotz told him that we are going to try to create predictability in front of you. Now, he said there will always be breakdowns. There will always be things that you try to do or nights where it doesn't work. But generally, you are going to know where the shots are coming from. We are going to set it up so that we only allow the shots we want. And I followed up with him last year, and he said, it's totally true. Like, you know, he said, you know, you're going to have your bad nights where it goes sideways. But generally, the Islanders only allow the shots they want to allow. And another coach told me that he looked at stats that teams that had the puck in their own zone the most. And he said the stats they had was there's no team that's in their own end more than the Islanders. But the shot quality that they allow is among the best because they pack it in, they keep to the outside, and they say, if you want to shoot, you shoot from there. And that's a team that understands its role, is disciplined enough to play to its role. And I think, you know, I think in hockey, it's about as much a team sport as anything can be. And those guys play it team-wide.
Friedge, it was great of you to do this. Thanks so much.
All right, guys. Have a great night.
Thanks, Elliot.
That's Elliot Friedman of Hockey Night in Canada and the NHL on Sportsnet. And again, Elliot and trying to read this here. Elliot and Jeff Merrick will be part of our Scotiabank Wednesday night hockey pregame at 6:30 p.m. tomorrow on Sportsnet Ontario. Puck drop will be just after 7. The Leafs and John Tavares go to the island to take on the Islanders. John Tavares, second game back in the island since
remember
leaving.
That last one. That
yeah, was, well, and this, and this time we can be pretty much assured that the backup goaltender will not be starting, as was the case. As was the case last year when John Tavares returned to the island. It'll be Frederik Andersen in goal. And at least initially it appears as if Kasperi Kapanen has drawn in alongside Zach Hyman and John Tavares, Zach Hyman returning to the lineup, Mitch Marner in a walking boot out for a month at least, at which point he will be reevaluated. These things, though, ankle injuries tend to they tend to develop at an or tend to heal at an irregular pace. There are some guys who, quite frankly, return faster
right
from ankle injuries than other guys.
He's got youth on his side. It usually helps a little bit.
But and anyhow, he initially it looks like Kasperi Kapanen will draw in and get that assignment alongside Zach Hyman and John Tavares. And boy, if you're the Leafs, you've been talking all year. And Mike Babcock in particular has been talking all year about wanting to get Zach Hyman back and the importance of having Zach Hyman back and how just having Zach Hyman makes this team whole. Now you're getting Zach Hyman back and you're not going to have Mitch Marner. So as we said on Monday, you're going to be waiting. Let's assume the 4-week time period holds up, Richard. Essentially, you're going to be waiting till after Christmas to see what exactly you have, how what you have now compares to what you thought you had when you put this team together in training camp. And that's something I don't think, well, I certainly don't think anybody expected it, but that's created kind of a new wrinkle for the Leafs in terms of their ability to evaluate themselves.
So Mike Babcock's comments about, this is what you want your coach to say, whether he believes it or not, but this now gives opportunity for other players and for the organization to see what those other players are. Specific to the Islanders game, Jeff, I'm curious to see what the reaction is to Tavares, because the last game was about as intense isn't the right word, but it's been a long time since I've seen a crowd in the NHL bloodthirsty. I'm using a specific word regarding a player. That was about as intense a scene as I've seen, certainly during a regular season game. I would imagine that's going to be dissipated a little bit, but it will be interesting to watch the reaction that he gets. But I think Elliott hit it, Jeff. I think the next month, we're going to see a lot of if they're going to win, they're going to win like how they did against the Flyers. Kind of ugly wins, overtime wins, shootout wins. We're not going to be seeing, a lot of 5-0 victories.
And the one thing it's going to do is a lot of us have been harping about we want to see different power play alignments. It's not working. We don't like the way the Leafs are entering the other team's zone in the power play. Well, you've got forced change. So
absolutely,
Let's see what happens now. I mean, I'm with you. I understand that initially William Nylander is going to draw into that unit. But my goodness, without having Mitch Marner, if ever there was an opportunity to open the door to having Tyson Barrie and Morgan Rielly on the power play at the same time, which has to happen. At some point, it has to happen. And I think Mike Babcock knows that at some point it has to happen. But my goodness, to me, that would be my first move right now is putting Tyson Barrie out there, because they've, along with Rielly, because they got
to
get him going.
You can't get to where you want to be unless he's not great.
And I'll tell you something else. You traded for the guy, and I understand that Kyle Dubas made the trade, but I really believe when you trade for a guy in his walk year, you owe it to that player. And I mean owe it. You owe it to that player to put him in a position where he can maximize his value. It's the right thing to do in terms of the culture of the game. You don't acquire a guy going into his walk year, especially a guy Tyson Barrie's age. You don't acquire him going into his walk year and then say, okay, you know what? We're not going to give you a chance to maximize.
They traded a quality asset for him. The Avs got a second line center. I know he was a third line center here in Kadri, but he's a quality player with an excellent contract. So I'm with you. If it's going to be a 1-year return, Jeff, you have to try to get as much out of that 1 year.
The story involving the Houston Astros and Major League Baseball and the alleged cheating has taken a couple of turns in the last half hour. A rather pointed statement from the Houston Astros that will do absolutely nothing to take away from the feeling around baseball that there seems to be a whole lot of fire behind the smoke of this story. Richard Deitch and myself will talk about it when we come back. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. If it's all right.
Be joined by Amy Trask, CBS Sports, in a few minutes. This is a statement from the Houston Astros. If you're just joining us, you know that the Athletic, Ken Rosenthal and Evan Drellick, have a story today detailing allegations of sign stealing by the Houston Astros in 2017, quoting Mike Fiers, a former pitcher with the Astros, about not only the sign stealing, but essentially not just the fact that they're sign stealing, but how they go about doing it. This is the Houston Astros statement, which effectively sounds to me like an admission of guilt. But this is the Houston Astros statement. Regarding the story posted by The Athletic earlier today, the Houston Astros organization has begun an investigation in cooperation with Major League Baseball. It would not be appropriate to comment further on this matter at this time. Now, what I mean by admission of guilt, I may have gone over top a little bit. Generally, and it's not just the Houston Astros, any organization's first reaction would be deny, 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 deny. Now, maybe the Astros learned from what happened during the World Series, the mishandling of the Brandon Taubman situation. This is certainly a very simple statement. But I'm really wondering here, since the World Series started, we saw the Houston Astros have to fire their assistant general manager because of comments he relayed to female reporters regarding Roberto Osuna's domestic violence the charges. We've seen the Ryan family essentially remove themselves. Nolan Ryan, no longer associated with the organization. His son being sort of shuffled off into the back. And now we've seen the story come out suggesting, detailing how the Houston Astros went about stealing signs in 2017. And my initial reaction was, Mike Fiers can't be the only guy who knows about this. The Toronto Blue Jays bench coach is Dave Hudgens, who was there in 2017. My initial reaction is, if that was the case, somebody would have come out and said something. But, one, not everybody's wired that way. You know, there's an element of keeping secrets in every sport. And if you don't, and people find out that you're not keeping secrets, might end up losing your job. But secondly, Richard, and this is something people need to keep in mind, this does not mean that it was going on every pitch. And this is, I remember talking to F.P. Santangelo about this. F.P. Santangelo, one of the great sign stealers I've covered. And he made the point that the Expos had a brawl with the San Francisco Giants over this. And I don't think FP would mind me saying, he said, you know what's funny is I do it. I hadn't done it at all that game. And the Giants assumed that I was stealing signs. And his point was, we don't do it all the time. You don't do it in every pitch because then you get caught. It's like anything else, Richard. If you have something on somebody, you save it. You keep your powder dry. So that's something to keep in mind with this, that there's no indication that this went on every pitch of every game, but there's certainly evidence that it happened at some point in 2017.
Well, first, I guess it's an improvement that the Astros did not send out a statement that defamed a reporter. So they're, you know, they've improved.
That was very good.
Yeah, they've improved at least that way. It's interesting, Jeff. I read this more, the statement more of them just sort of wanting to put something out for the sake of putting something out. And then, ultimately the organization is going to eventually have to address this. What's different to me, and again, you cover the sport far more than I do. What's different to me about this statement is the Astros as an organization have been hyper aggressive mm-hmm. when they have been mm-hmm. charged with something, right?
Yep.
So most of their statements are their de facto mode is to fight back, or yep. their de facto mode is to counter the charge.
Absolutely.
What is fascinating to me is this is the exact opposite.
This is not even benign. This is a like I said, I don't know if I'd say admission of guilt, but it's a, to me, it reads like, you know what? You caught us.
Right. This is more like every other organization that sort of wants to just get something out there and then react. So that's what's fascinating to me is they have been kind of like the testosterone FU organization. And this statement's the exact opposite. This statement is like almost going in the corner a little bit and sort of cradling and saying, okay, we're going to let MLB handle it. I am with you, though. I think what ultimately will be found is it's not happening on every pitch, but the question will be if they're ultimately found guilty, and you would have a better sense of me, is like, what does MLB do? Like, do you find, like, how, what is even a fine for this? Or a punishment for this?
I mean, you know, there's a long list of rules. Major League Baseball has allowed tablets and dugouts now for video and that. There's a long list of rules. They're pretty detailed rules. And
Would you fine them $1 million bucks?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. Draft picks, money.
I think that's what ultimately it is, but
I'll tell you one of the things that's happened here though, Richard. One of the things that's happened here is if we find there's something to this, I think people are going to view their World Series as
100%
as jaded isn't the word I'm
just like
for.
The Patriots for Spygate. You never look at the organization the same way.
Bingo.
Yeah, always.
Bingo. And that's
It sucks for the players, but that's the reality of sports.
And there are a couple things I want to say about this. First of all, Evan Drellick and Ken Rosenthal are among our best. Ken Rosenthal, everybody knows Ken Rosenthal.
Yeah.
Evan Drellick's really good. If you read this story, this is a reported story. This isn't a column.
Right.
This is a reported story. And the other thing, for Mike Fiers to come out and...
They confirmed it. They got a guy
confirmed,
in the record. Right, yeah.
But for him to do that...
Ballsy.
...is unbelievably ballsy.
Yeah, I would say this. Again, understand I work there, so I am not an independent observer. I work at The Athletic in addition to this place. There is no way, Jeff, and you know this from your years in the newspaper business, there's no way they're publishing this story.
Not a chance.
Unless they vetted the hell out
not
of it.
A chance.
You're just not, because you would be subject to so much stuff from the Astros. Yeah.
And it's
a guy with reputationally one of the best in the business, and Ken Rosenthal, you know he's got.
And I'll tell you another thing about Kenny Rosenthal, and we'll take a break in a minute. Ken Rosenthal would never, ever, 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 ever torch a source.
Correct.
Unless he was 100% certain of what he had. Amy Trask is our NFL insider. She's with CBS Sports. She's one of our favorites. She's going to join us. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan on Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Man, you give Derek Brandeo a day off, and he comes back, and he's like, just loaded.
The music,
loaded for bear.
The music for the radio
solid.
Today has been great. We had Public Enemy before, I think it was Bring the Noise, and then some Beastie Boys here. Really solid.
Derek Brandeo is really
bringing it today. Bringing my era. Yeah.
Your era.
Wouldn't mind some NWA down the road.
Yeah, let's do that. That's good. That will get us banned.
Blair's banned in Winnipeg.
Huh?
It's like NWA was always banned somewhere. Banned in Detroit, banned in New York.
Anyhow. You got some Prophets of Rage going. Find the 90 seconds of clean lyrics that Prophets of Rage have done in the... I think there's... You're still trying
Derek,
to find
actually, I do have a request down the road. Can you give me some disposable Heroes of Hypocrisy, at least at one point?
What?
He knows what I'm talking about.
Let's bring Amy Trask in. Amy, save the conversation. Deitch is trying to channel his inner street dude here.
Well, Amy knows all about the streets, given that she used to work for Al Davis.
And now I work for the Big Three, which is Ice Cube. And so if anyone's going to be in charge of the playlist, I think it's going to be me.
There you go. You've got...
You bring the street cred in this conversation, given you work with Ice Cube.
Well, thank you very much.
Although some of that street cred's hurt by the fact that you work for corporate CBS, but nobody's perfect, Amy.
Come on, there's a meld there, isn't there?
The hard, mean streets of West 52nd Street and 6th Avenue in New York. All right, Amy, let's go to your bailiwick here, and that's the National Football League. What did you think of last night's game? I have to admit, incredibly entertaining. And as I was telling Jeff in one of the last segments, I totally miscalculated on the Niners this year. They're a legit Super Bowl contender, and I didn't see it. But even in a loss, they're a very good team.
Yeah, terrific, terrific game. So much of what we've loved. And I will tell you as a side note before getting into the question you just asked, I did say aloud to those with whom I was watching the game, how do they do this on the East Coast? I mean, even games that don't go to overtime, they're really late, those night games on the East Coast. And this California girl is very happy they end earlier out here. As to the 49ers, I expected them to be improved. I certainly did not expect them to be 8-0 and then 8-1. Last week on CBS, as you referenced, I played my raise your hand game, where I love to say raise your hand if. And I said raise your hand if you expected the 49ers to be undefeated 8 games into the season. And anybody who raises their hand, I'm going to question their credibility, because even if we expected them to be improved, they're playing really well. But boy, oh boy, I also named Russell Wilson as my, to this point in the season, MVP. And I did that before last night.
Well, I will say this, though. It's Russell Wilson is almost, I wouldn't say he's the Mike Trout of the NFL, but you're probably in pretty safe ground when you list Russell Wilson as an MVP candidate almost every year, aren't you? At least in the discussion.
I agree. Oh, absolutely, because when you factor in, however you define MVP, whether MVP of his team, he is MVP of the league as a whole, he certainly is in the discussion. But I would posit for your consideration that he has, over the course of his career, done more for his team than most any other quarterback for his in the following regard. There was a year, it was either 2 or 3 years ago, he led the entire team in rushing, and he threw well, and he reads defense as well. I just think the world of him.
And honestly, Amy, if that Super Bowl goes a different way, Pete Carroll hands off to Marshawn Lynch, you're thinking of Russell Wilson's legacy totally different. That extra Super Bowl, I think, changes. I'm not saying people don't think he's a great player. He obviously is. But you know what I mean, Amy? That one additional Super Bowl, you start thinking of him differently, I think, historically.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. And now that you've got me all het up about that play call, you've got Marshawn Lynch, who, by the way, went to the University of California, my alma mater. And you don't hand the ball to him. I'm still incredulous about that incomprehensible play call from my perspective. But I digress, and you're right as to Russell.
There you go, Pete Carroll, USC guy. All right, Amy, one of the two teams that in the last couple of weeks have at least surprised me in terms of going a little bit backwards are the Kansas City Chiefs and the Los Angeles Rams, two teams that I think many people would have considered, you know, would not be surprised to see in the Super Bowl again. From your perspective, what do you think is going on with each of those teams right now?
Well, look, from the Rams, one has to wonder, and I don't know that this is the case, but one has to wonder if the proverbial Super Bowl hangover is a piece of this. I remember after we, because when I was with the Raiders and we lost the Super Bowl, Andrea Kramer said to me shortly thereafter, do you think you're going to have a problem with the Super Bowl hangover? And I looked at her. I said, oh, please. I use my Chad Johnson voice. Child, please. But we did have a bit of a hangover. So I don't know if that's impacting the Rams at all. They've had some key injuries on the offensive line. And I think, and this is just me supposing, that the Gurley injury has had a bit more of an impact than they're letting on. As to the Chiefs, some injuries as well. But they continue to have some of the same defensive problems that they had last year. And look, you've got Patrick Mahomes, and you've got and I do recognize he was out for a bit, but you cannot always expect your offense to be putting up the number of points it has to put up to make up for a defense that gives up a lot of points.
Amy, we're going to get a chance to see a pretty good quarterback matchup this weekend in Baltimore and Houston. Baltimore. I think Baltimore is a game lead, I believe, in Houston. So this would also give them, I think, a head to head. If I'm if if I'm not mistaken. This is very kind of a layman's type question, but what's the difference right now between between Lamar and Deshaun Watson in terms of quarterback? Like, what separates them right now?
The teams as a whole.
Okay.
I think that Lamar, they're both spectacular. You're absolutely right. And there's a very, very technical term for a matchup of two quarterbacks like this when we get to see it. Ooh la la. I mean, this is just a delicious, delicious matchup of talent on both sides. I think Baltimore's doing a better job supporting Lamar than Houston has been supporting Deshaun. I think the coaching is better in Baltimore than it is in Houston.
Amy, one of the things that John Harbaugh does in Baltimore is he really gambles a lot on fourth down. And maybe gambles is the wrong phrase, but he goes for it a lot on fourth down. And I wonder, and again, you've been in the league, you've seen the league for a long time. In your time with the Raiders, did you remember anybody in the league discussing that, or is that a relatively new phenomenon where they maybe use analytics and more mathematics? Because I find what Harbaugh does really, really interesting, and I'm kind of surprised more teams don't do it.
Well, I'll say yes and yes in answer to both of your, or to answer your question, I'll say yes and yes. Yes, it was discussed while I was in the league, but yes, analytics is more prevalent now, and it is discussed more now from an analytics perspective. But the issue of going for it or not, whether you're incorporating analytics or not, has always been a topic. And one thing John does that I love, and we saw it when Baltimore played Seattle, is he checks in with Lamar and he checks in with his players. And before they went for it on fourth in Seattle, he said to Lamar, do we want to do this? So yes, he's using analytics, but he's also checking in with his players and saying, can we do this? Do you want to do this? And Lamar said, hell yes, let's do it. And I think, look, analytics is a great tool, but it's a tool. And if you've got a tool belt full of tools, that's one. But I like how he melds it with other things.
What are you expecting from New England this weekend?
They're going to be mad.
Yeah, they're going to be. They're going to be a little bent out of shape, aren't they?
They are. And look, there's some deficiencies in the roster that spectacular coaching and tremendous quarterback play are making up for. But I would not want to be New England's opponent this week after they came off that loss and then had a bye. I would not like that at all.
Amy, did you see the Bucks releasing Vernon Hargreaves after a benching? What'd you make of that?
Hard to know because we don't know what went on behind the scenes. Clearly, they had made a decision that, you know, talent didn't trump whatever it was that was going on behind the scenes. And if it did, I'm sure they would have kept him. Steve Keim from the Arizona Cardinals once said, of people putting talent ahead of everything, that, you know, if a general manager thought that Hannibal Lecter. That if he thought that Hannibal Lecter could run a 440, he'd convince himself he had an eating disorder. And so, you know, clearly whatever was going on didn't warrant keeping him on the roster. In the minds of the Buccaneers, I will not be surprised at all to see him sign somewhere else.
All right, Amy, last question. I want to be angry before you leave us. What is the weather today in
California?
What is the weather today in your part of California?
Well, you know, I was so delighted that the station was so accommodating and letting me come on at this later slot than originally proposed because I had to get back to where I had cellular connectivity. And just so you know, I zipped down the coast with the top down on my car in the sunshine. According to my car, it was 75 at the beach.
75 Fahrenheit.
75. Okay.
By the way, I consider fall. 75 and below is fall, 70 and below is winter.
Don't ask Amy, Jeff, if November begins winter.
Yeah, that's the debate we have in Canada.
Is
November the last month of the fall or the first month of the winter? That's a Canadian.
75 is the demarcation. When it's 75, it's fall.
Amy, thanks for this.
Thanks for having me, man.
See you, Amy.
Amy Trask. I wonder if she stopped at an In-N-Out Burger on the way down. Convertible. Sunshine In-N-Out Burger. That is like...
No one Trask's jobs. That's probably a pretty nice convertible.
Yeah, I was going to say.
That's no jalopy.
Anyhow.
Wow, imagine driving down a coast right now, the top down. Ugh.
You've done that drive, haven't you?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, the drive is the best.
Yeah. California's beautiful, though. You've been in an earthquake. I haven't. That's scares the hell out of me.
No, I love California. I would.
You'd move?
I'd move to California in a heartbeat. I'd move to L.A. in a heartbeat. I'm that guy. I don't mind the driving in L.A. Everything about traffic sucks. Everything about it I like. I would have absolutely no problem living in L.A. Everything about L.A. I like. Everything. I would take California basically over any other state.
Yeah, I mean, California has far more pluses than minuses.
But I mean, SoCal. I like SoCal.
Really? And oh, I love Northern California. I love San Francisco.
I always feel I'm in danger of falling off into the ocean in Northern California.
Really?
Because of the earthquake. Yeah, the earthquake thing.
You don't find Northern California more intellectually stimulating, more art, better food?
No. Oh, L.A.'s.
L.A.'s got great food,
LA's
too.
LA's got good. Yeah, it's just the only thing with L.A. is...
It's a little too much traffic and a little too much. It's a little too much tude. It's a little too much. Everybody's in the business. Everybody's a little too beautiful.
See, I thought that's weird. I mean, maybe it's just the places I used to go to when I was in L.A., but I didn't see a lot of beautiful people.
Neither did I. That's why I kind of like New York. New York has all that, but also New York just also has like somebody walking down the street saying F you. And you kind of, in a way, respect that because it's not fake. It's honest. Anyway.
Yeah.
Look, California's beautiful.
Yeah.
Highly recommend visiting.
Yeah.
before it falls into the ocean or secedes from the United States.
Well, yeah, that's not likely to happen. California's spectacular. Anyhow, now I'm thinking
Visions
of Amy Trask driving down the road in her convertible in California. I'm about to jump in the car and drive down the Gardner.
not exactly the same.
Dodging the potholes and the trucks. It'll be spectacular. I won't have my top down, though. Convertible orb. Any other.
All right. Tim and Sid coming up, right?
Tim and Sid coming up. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back tomorrow, I believe. Have a great day, everybody. Good afternoon from Toronto. Need a leg up in your picks? Oddshark.net is your source for the latest odds from leading authorities, expert editorial content, and detailed matchup picks. Looking for statistics and trends for an upcoming game? Oddshark.net has those too, and it's free. Expert in-depth analysis, stats, numbers, and trends to help you make the sharp game day picks, whether you want to get it on the football action, tonight's hockey game, or anything in between. Go to oddsshark.net. This is not a gambling site.